Geek Podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Clive Oppenheimer, and he's a Cambridge volcanologist, and we're going to talk about everything from volcanoes to earthquakes to science, politics, and a whole multitude of topics. This is a pretty all-encompassing and long podcast, so, but before I get into that, you know, I don't usually say much. I try to book good guests, and I try to ask good questions, and I have enough faith in the listeners to, come away with it, with something. And in this interview, I may have taken a mocking tone, and I might sound a little frustrated with a lot of things going on right now, so I'm apologizing in advance to anybody who I'm going to offend, but I truly believe that we live in an incredible era of humanity, and the way things are going, with all the challenges that we face as a species and civilization, from climate change to human hubris and war and all, we have to take advantage of the opportunities that we have today, and we can't get all hyperbolic and freak out and allow people to push doom theories anymore. Something has to change. We have to look at what's going on around us with a critical eye and use logic and deductive reasoning and not freak out. And I know I might be a little bit of a hypocrite here because I freak out sometimes and I'm human and I have a brain, but we can't allow people to keep manipulating others to generate fear, to serve their agendas or generate ad revenue or whatever reason. I mean, like, if we were to throw ads up on Solar IMG, we'd be pulling in some serious coin. I mean, we're almost at 1 million hits now. Some of our podcasts have gotten up to 7,000 downloads. We're seen in over 50 countries every day. So, you know, instead we're using junk equipment and spending countless hours and effort with our community partners and our team members and our supporters, and it allows us to learn and speak with so many incredible people, and we get to share that with the world, and that's something that was previously inaccessible, and the chosen few who had that ability didn't go there, so, because it wasn't expedient, but I think Solar IMG is a true success story, and it's really, you know, incredible, and I really encourage everyone to look a little deeper. And, if you got $5, please throw it in the PayPal. If you're rich, throw in 100. I mean, like, if you're broke, don't worry, we'll figure out a way to keep this going. So, I'm a big believer in Gene Roddenberry's vision of the future. And, I think that we're going to get there. So, thank you to all of the guests and all of the people working behind the scenes and everyone else, the supporters, the listeners, the team members, and we live in a beautiful world. So, generations have worked tirelessly. People have sacrificed a lot to get us here. I can't help but think of the service people and everything. So without further ado, we're going to get to the interview, and I'm sorry about the quality. Our microphone hasn't been delivered yet, but thanks to people who believe in us, I got a microphone, and thank you. So here we go. Today we have a very special guest. I know that I say every podcast is special, but today's really special podcast. We have Dr. Clive Oppenheimer, and he is a volcanologist with the Geography Department of Cambridge University, and when he's not teaching and tinkering with seismos, he's running conferences and rummaging around volcanoes, studying the outgassing and all sorts of stuff. Dr. Oppenheimer, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Rick. Tinkering and rummaging, that's my speciality, so great to talk to you, and be looking forward to this.
I have to admit, I'm a little bit intimidated by the subject matter because I don't really know too much about volcanoes. My understanding is limited to the paper mache I modeled in grade school.
Well, that's probably, you know, pretty representative of the state of the art of volcanology, I would think. Especially if you had it plugged into some red dye or something that erupted out the top.
Yeah. I had the baking soda and the vinegar, and it was great. Luckily, I've got a great group of people on the Facebook page and other groups, and they posed a wonderful series of questions. So I guess we're going to start with the recent discovery that I think 20 or 25 areas have become volcanically active in the last 2 months, and I was hoping to know if that was indicative of the normal pattern, or is that anomalous, or...
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, often when these events seem to coincide, we get an impression that there's a sort of increased frequency of earthquakes and volcanic eruptions and so on. But if you actually look at the statistics over the last centuries for the volcanic record, there are no real clear indications of any real changes in activity. There are certainly individual volcanoes might show some cycles and patterns, but if we look at the larger eruptions, the frequency over the last centuries, millennia, doesn't really show a lot of change. So I think it's more about a heightened awareness of extreme events, and also much better reporting, of course. Now we know instantly something that happens on the other side of the world.
And we have those wonderful videos, too, that are coming through. The Japanese have their amazing cameras. We've seen the ones in Hawaii. Actually, speaking of Hawaii, have there been any significant changes to the system in Hawaii? And if there have been or haven't been, what should the locals be looking out for?
Well, I have to admit, I haven't followed what's going on in Hawaii too closely, but broadly speaking, it's same old, same old, I think, there, in that the eruption has been more or less continuous for over 25 years now. So it's been a very, very consistent volcano pumping out a few cubic meters of lava a second over that time period. I think one of the interesting developments in just the last few years in particular has been this lava lake that's appeared in the summit crater of Halemaumau. That's the first time in around a century that there's been lava, I think, in the summit crater. And that's provided a very interesting direct window into the upper part of the magma plumbing system of the volcano, because until this time, most of the lava has been coming out a little way down the rift. So that's a very interesting scientific opportunity.
And previously you were mentioning the millennial cycles and the centuries-old cycles. Do the individual volcanoes have their own cycles, and do they match up with others, and how do they relate to such issues as global warming and cooling?
Ooh, as a cluster of questions. I mean, individual volcanoes, some of them behave in a completely random fashion. So if an eruption happened last year on a particular volcano, it might mean that has really no statistical significance on how likely it is to have another eruption next year. Other volcanoes do show some quite consistent patterns. One is Mount Etna in Sicily, which if it's had a very big eruption, likelihood is there's going to be a little time gap until the next event. So volcanoes vary. Some definitely show some kind of cycles and patterns, and others appear to be a lot more random. Remind me, what was you were asking about the relation to climate change? That's an interesting one. If we look at a geological perspective, then we can see, for instance, at the end of the last ice age, pulses of increased volcanism, particularly at high latitudes, places like Iceland, Alaska, perhaps the Aleutians, volcanoes that were covered in a lot of glacial ice. And when that ice melted very suddenly at the end of the ice age, that led to a lot more melting to feed some of the volcanoes, and that some of those volcanoes then erupted pretty rapidly afterwards. So there are links between global climate change and rates of volcanism, and there's some speculation what that might mean for the future with continuing and accelerated deglaciation, particularly of high latitude volcanoes. Could we see some statistical increase in rates of volcanism?
And that reminds me of something we had discussed previously, the water and the there was some mention of the water affecting the explosive characteristics of the volcano, or
That's right. Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, the primary force driving volcanic activity is the magma, the molten rock that fuels volcanoes, and a lot of what occurs depends on processes going on below the surface of the earth. However, there are quite a lot of extrinsic environmental factors that can trigger an eruption, can modulate an eruption, the character of that event, and water is certainly one of them. There seems to be a link, for instance, in Montserrat between collapses of the lava dome that's been growing on Soufrière Hills volcano and the rainy season, and this may be related to how rainwater percolates into the lava dome and may trigger some explosive activity. Of course, volcanoes that are on islands or near the coast, there's plenty of potential there for water to get into an eruptive vent and to explode lead to much more violent explosions. In the case of the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in Iceland a couple of years ago, the role played by ice cover was very significant in generating this very fine ash through very violent explosions in the crater. So water certainly plays a very important role.
Well, the magma, you see, I don't really understand how the magma flows from the core and how that works. And could you maybe give us a primer on that and explain, is magma movement on the rise, or is it steady, or?
Sure. I mean, magma is generated in a number of tectonic environments on the Earth. It's generated under the mid-oceanic ridges, places like, a lot of volcanism we never get to see because it goes unobserved on the deep seabed. There are volcanoes and magma production in the so-called subduction zones, where one tectonic plate dives back into the Earth's mantle, and those are volcanoes such as the ones in the Andes, Philippines, Japan, and so on. And we do get some volcanoes in the middle of nowhere, Hawaii, some of the volcanoes in the middle of the Sahara. So all of these involve production of magma. The timescales of tens of thousands of years, there's no particular evidence of increased rates of magma production. Typically, the magma is produced anywhere from a few tens to 100, 150 kilometers depth below the surface. And because that molten rock is a little bit less dense than the surrounding rocks, it can rise up through the crust. Very typically, beneath active volcanoes, there might be a chamber or a reservoir of magma that's 10 kilometers or so down. And that can sit in the crust for decades, centuries, thousands of years, and then occasionally something will trigger an eruption whereby that molten rock forces its way up to the surface and will then erupt. Of course, the volcanoes that we see, they're not randomly distributed around the Earth. We don't have any here in the United Kingdom, for instance. So they are related to very specific deep-seated processes going on in the Earth. There's obviously a little bit of detail to that, but maybe that gives something of a picture of why we've got volcanoes where they are.
Well, I guess it gives you an excuse to go jet-setting around the world. One thing I think is really cool about the magma is that it can be used as a proxy for measuring the previous state of the Earth's magnetic field. What do we know about the magnetic field and polar drift and polar shifts from these rocks that have solidified and retained the magnetic orientation of the time when they solidified?
Well, one of the very important lines of evidence to demonstrate that seafloor spreading was occurring and connected with the drift of the continents was from magnetic measurements, some very important ones carried out south of Iceland in the Atlantic Ocean. As lavas cool down, they pass through the so-called Curie point, where the the iron minerals effectively line up with the prevailing magnetic field of the Earth. So if you can imagine, there's lots of little compasses in the lavas, and that literally gets set in stone, and we can measure the direction that all these little compasses are pointing in. So, for instance, if you go south of Iceland and tow a magnetometer backwards and forwards, you see these stripes, so-called magnetic stripes, which indicate reversals of the magnetic field of the Earth, the North Magnetic Pole becoming the South Magnetic Pole, in a somewhat random fashion, with intervals of tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years. So that's been a very important tool, actually, for reconstructing how the plate tectonics has operated over timescales of hundreds of millions of years. And in addition, there seem to be some interesting links, actually, between what goes on magnetically in the Earth's core and the huge eruptions that have punctuated the geological record called flood basalts, the continental flood basalts, that a very famous one was the eruption of the Deccan Traps in India something like 64 million years ago. One idea is that these huge outpourings of lava at the Earth's surface are ultimately related to the dynamics and flow of the Earth's outer core, its iron-nickel outer core. So there could be some links there on a very big scale between the magnetic field and volcanism.
Well, with the links and the whole magnetic field connection, do any of these cycles seem to jive up with any astronomical or heliospheric cycles, for example, that you're aware of?
Well, in the case of these flood basalts, of which there are perhaps half a dozen major episodes in the last 250 million years, there have been a lot of theories, actually, as to how these arise, and particularly a lot of interest because they coincide with mass extinction seen in the fossil record. And it's almost back in vogue again, actually, to think that the demise of the dinosaurs and countless other fauna at the end of the Cretaceous period might have a lot to do with the eruption of the Deccan lavas in India. And at the same time, there have been other theories that somehow it is related to extraterrestrial effects and intersections of the Earth's orbit with cometary clouds and so on. And so there's a sort of enduring debate about extraterrestrial versus terrestrial causes of some of the large outpourings of lavas on Earth and the associated extinctions. As for sort of heliospheric physics, I'm not really aware of much of a link there, and I'm not sure really how strong the forces are that would be, you know, capable of triggering an eruption, for instance. It's not clear to me that those are sufficient to do much for a volcano.
Because my team and I were looking quite a bit at earthquakes. We're looking at the sun, and we're seeing the Ring of Fire being, you know, fairly active. We're not sure if there's a connection. I guess the only one of the few working theories that we can come up with is that during some of these energy events that go into the poles, perhaps energy gets transferred into the core, heats the magma. Maybe can it change viscosity? Can it get more thick and more thin on the inside? I mean, energy doesn't just disappear. It has to be changed into something else. It's the physics, right?
That's right. I mean, you've sent me, I suppose, I mean, you've got plenty of energy to play with clearly in volcanoes. Just the temperatures and quantities of magmas that are erupted are a testament to the energies involved. And, I mean, ultimately, I would say that these are reflections of the ongoing decay of radioactive elements, uranium, thorium, potassium, that are in the Earth's mantle. as well as the still the primordial heat left over from the Earth's formation 4.5 billion years ago. So I think there's plenty of internal energy to drive these volcanic processes. And I'm not sure really how you would modulate much of that with solar output. I mean, I think there could be, there could certainly be some feedbacks between volcanism and climate change that you know, could be linked to the Milankovitch cycles, for instance, mm-hmm. as a result of redistributing water around the planet and changing stress distributions on volcanoes, either loading them up with ice or unloading them during melting or loading a volcano by sea level change. So I think on those kinds of timescales, I can see that there could well be some interesting links.
Well, how long did the cooling period after the Cretaceous era last?
The cooling period, the global cooling period, I suppose, is...
if it was the Cretaceous, I might be off a bit there.
It was much warmer in the Cretaceous than it is today. And there's been overall a cooling trend over the last 40, 50 million years. And that brought us 2.5 million years ago to the onset of the glacial and interglacial cycles, the ice ages. So we see that steady cooling of the Earth. And again, there are a number of theories as to explain this. One popular one has been things like the uplift of the Tibetan Plateau following the collision of the Indian subcontinent with Eurasia, which began about 40 million years ago. So mountain building has been a popular idea. Closure of the Isthmus of Panama, cutting off direct contact between Pacific and Atlantic oceans, the opening of the circumpolar ocean around Antarctica. So these are some of the ideas to account for the kind of long-term cooling that we've seen since the end of the Cretaceous. But again, volcanism could play a role in there. There have been one or two smaller flood basalt episodes, the 30 million years ago, huge outpourings of lava forming the Ethiopian and Yemeni plateau. So there are certainly some big volcanic events superimposed in there.
And another question from one of the folks on the internet. They were asking that, they said that since earthquakes happen, they're very sudden and they're easy to measure, that they can plot them very easily. But in the instance of volcanoes, since the duration may be longer and there may be complex eruptions, what would be a good way for the amateur scientists to plot or graph some of these types of things?
Well, I think, again, seismic data actually are very relevant. And I suppose even in the case of an earthquake, one large earthquake is possibly preceded by some foreshocks, and there will be aftershocks that might continue for years or even decades. So I suppose even an earthquake cycle can play out over a period of time. There might be migration of earthquakes as one part of a fault is de-stressed through an event that might load up the stress on another part of the fault. So, I mean, in the case of volcanoes, again, as you say, an eruption can go on for a long time. If you look at the Montserrat case, that's been on and off since 1995. Mount St. Helens had its big eruption in 1980 and then came back to life in the mid-90s. So volcanoes certainly can have very protected activity, and I think there are lots of ways to follow that from observations through visual observations through to looking at earthquakes and the locations of earthquakes, the frequency, how many earthquakes per day occur beneath a volcano. Of course, I mean, this means you do need to have a seismometer, or you need access to data that are being recorded by an observatory. I don't know how much to recommend people to go around trying to measure gases and things like that on volcanoes, just because they are somewhat hazardous environments, of course. But I think there's plenty of scope for amateurs to contribute to volcanology and in lots of different ways.
Well, luckily there's the many, many different resources. There's EMSC, there's the USGS, and even Stanford now is offering seismometers for institutions, small organizations. They're sending them out and creating networks, which is pretty cool. I'd recommend everyone check out that Stanford initiative. But I want to ask you what it's like to go and actually do the gas thing. Before we move on to that, I'll try and keep it brief. The Mexico quake is really fresh in everyone's mind. There was the 7.4 yesterday, and I happened to notice the another ionospheric disturbance. There was density created, but one of our astute readers happened to note an increase in the sea surface temperature in the area around there. I don't know how close, because it was a land earthquake, but it got me to thinking about undersea volcanoes, and I know that one was recently discovered in detail. But there's also the problems happening now with the undersea cables, and I'm wondering what's going on with the undersea volcanoes. Do we have a good handle on that?
No, as you say, there've been a few observations, a few glimpses from sort of autonomous submarines that have captured volcanic events on the seabed. Some beautiful results from the East Pacific Rise that captured ongoing lava flows. I mean, generally, our understanding of the submarine volcanism is pretty limited because of the difficulty of accessing these regions. We think globally that it probably accounts for something like 80% or more of the global rate of volcanism. So a lot more is going on underwater. But generally, the water depths, for example, over a mid-ocean ridge are sufficient that it suppresses a lot of the explosive activity that we're familiar with on land. So in broad terms, it's only as the depth of these submarine volcanoes sort of comes towards the shore that we notice them a bit more, and then, of course, they can be very explosive because of the interaction of seawater with molten magma. I was just a thought, actually, on your point about the sort of accessibility of seismic data. I mean, I think in one way this is wonderful to sort of democratize science and so on. There is of course, a kind of downside of this, which is that you can get people who can make all sorts of pronouncements that they've seen something anomalous in the seismic data, and I think there have been a number of sort of instances where people have posted videos on YouTube calling for evacuations of such and such an area because of based on their interpretation. So there is a downside to making these data available, but I think, you know, broadly it's a positive thing.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. You know, for example, people are starting to say that the Mexico quake was man-made by HARP, or they knew about it and they didn't tell anyone, even though because they were having an exercise on the other side of the country. So it's kind of you know, it's interesting. I believe that, you know, the prediction of earthquakes is possible, but we don't have a handle on the science yet, and there isn't enough political willpower to really throw the funding out there to prove it or disprove it definitively. But I think there's something there, and hopefully in the next generation we'll figure it out. But how do we connect the amateur community and the people who really are driven and motivated to study this kind of thing with the science community? And if there is something there, how do we pass it up the chain? I'm kind of reminded of that scene in, what was it, Deep Impact, where the guy's driving down from the observatories, you know, the email gets lost and the comet, you know, but how do you, you know, do that? How do you bridge that gap?
I think it's happening. I mean, the USGS has the sort of Did You Feel It site, doesn't it? And I think there is, you know, a lot of valuable information coming in that helps to constrain the intensities of earthquakes and so on. And I suppose in other parts of the world, in China, for centuries, I think it's been taken very seriously, the kinds of observations that anyone might make, that their ducks behaved in an anomalous way, and I think there's sort of a network whereby information is fed from a very local level to a village chief, and then up the line. And if there are enough of these kinds of anomalous indications, that does feed into the science. I think in Indonesia as well, in the realm of volcano hazard assessment, that some of the sort of anomalous signs that people might notice, smelling gases where they hadn't been smelt before, or felt earthquakes, that also gets taken pretty seriously. And so I think there are, you know, there definitely are cases where that works, and it seems to me sort of increasingly with Twitter feeds and so on, that there is quite a lot to be gained from the wider community in getting rapid information on areas that have been affected by earthquakes and so on. So yeah, that seems very interesting to me. I think in terms of predicting earthquakes, that seems still quite a remote possibility in a way. I think they can be detected now fast enough, and magnitudes calculated fast enough, that there's the possibility to get a few seconds warning to shut down gas supplies, utilities, and so on, and prevent a lot of the secondary damage. But to get much more warning than that seems still quite far off. And I think with the seismic risk, it's really still got to come down to looking at the vulnerability of buildings. And you know, again, it's been said many times, earthquakes don't kill people, but buildings do. And there are so many parts of the world where we know there's a huge seismogenic potential and a very vulnerable building stock, and it's obviously going to be extremely expensive to do anything to retrofit that building stock. But we know the parts of the world that are threatened with the impacts of large earthquakes, and I don't know why we don't do more about that. The case of Port-au-Prince and Haiti is that's a very good example, very well characterized seismic risk, but not the political will or funding to retrofit buildings in an adequate way.
Well, solar IMG is apolitical, so we're not going to talk about Hades, that's for sure. Put a couple beers in me and I'll go on for hours. But if we can, do you have a time to answer a few more questions about the seismos?
Sure, I'll do my best.
Thanks. Yeah, well, the seismos are interesting. You know, the detection, I think they have systems now that detect the P waves or the S waves and send out an alert a couple seconds, like you mentioned. But the Mid-Atlantic Ridge quakes and stuff like that, how do they detect that? Do they triangulate, or how does that work?
Yes, I mean, there are a large enough earthquake will be detected the other side of the world. And effectively, it is a kind of triangulation to locate the epicenter and depth of an earthquake source. There are also ocean bottom seismometers that are deployed various parts of the world, and those are used also to locate earthquakes. That said, if you don't have any sensors, or you haven't got many sensors in a particular region, then you're not going to pick up the smaller earthquakes. And so there are definitely parts of the world where the seismicity, the local seismicity, is not so well constrained. There are other kinds of networks actually that are useful in the case of volcanism. One is infrasound, very, very low frequency sound waves that might be related to volcanic explosions. There are global networks of specialist microphones to detect these kinds of signals. Some of them are set up for the purposes of monitoring nuclear weapons tests, and they've also proved quite valuable actually in detecting volcanism in more remote parts of the world where there isn't much by way of local monitoring.
Well, the speaking of the poorly constrained ones and that, I guess a lot of people don't realize that a lot of the preliminary reports are computer generated, and the computers maybe in certain circumstances will err on the high side, and then, you know, once the seismologist looks at it, they'll correct it, and everybody's like, oh my gosh, they're hiding earthquakes, it's a conspiracy, what do we do? Oh, I want my tax money back. And like, but you know, you can see obviously where sometimes someone's bumped the seismo on the thing, or you know, something happening every hour, but sometimes you really do see those S waves, those low frequency types of sine waves, and I'm pretty familiar with those. Do you have any idea what causes those? They go over like hours in certain cases, and you just see them go up and down over big S.
Well, the surface waves are they're generated by large earthquakes in particular, and it's basically just the whole Earth ringing with the seismic energy. Traveling around the upper part of the crust. So, I mean, a very, very large earthquake of magnitude 8 or so will ring seismometers for a few days afterwards, day or two at least. And that, you know, in some ways that's the Earth ringing a bit like a bell.
Cool. Well, I've seen videos of guys in these tinfoil suits. I'm thinking about getting one just in case. You never know, right? But the, you know, the guy with the cup on the stick, and he's climbing up the edge of the volcano, and what's that like?
I think these suits are made of asbestos, right? Which is a bit dangerous. So I've personally never put one of these suits on. I think that you tend to see them on kind of TV documentaries of volcanoes, and it obviously makes it look far more deadly and threatening. So yeah, I've never got to wear one of these suits, but you know, by and large, you don't really want to get too close to active lava. And I suppose, I mean, in some ways, that's why increasingly volcanologists are using remote sensing techniques, whether that's spectrometers that can be deployed on the ground and pointed at a gas plume to make some measurements, or using satellites to make the measurements for us. And you know, conceivably now we can monitor a volcano the other side of the world with different kinds of satellite instruments and never have to leave our image processing laboratory to track the activity of that volcano.
I know that feeling. Well, before we wrap up, what do you have your eyes on for this year? What do you think we've got coming up in 2012 of things to keep our eye on?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of the volcanic events that catch our attention, the interesting thing is that they're most likely to be volcanoes we've never heard of. If you look at the last decades, the very big events, I'm thinking of Pinatubo in the Philippines, 91, El Chichon in Mexico, 1982, Chaiten in Chile, 2008. Last year in June, the Nabro volcano in Eritrea. None of these were thought of as being active volcanoes. Some of them weren't even really recognized as volcanoes full stop. And in some ways, this is simple to understand. The biggest eruptions are going to have taken a while to accumulate a large quantity of magma. So it could well be that these are volcanoes that haven't erupted in the historic period that we just don't have on our radar screen. So that for me is quite a sort of amazing lesson, that the big ones are going to catch us by surprise, because we're not going to have been looking at them. So that's a sort of, I think, an unpredictability to volcanism. On my personal horizon for this year, I'm hoping to do a bit more fieldwork in Eritrea, following up on the eruption of Nabro last year. Very, very fascinating events. I'll probably be back in Antarctica on Erebus towards the end of the year. That's no surprise. That volcano has been doing the same thing for thousands of years. And also hoping to start up a new project working on the Paektu volcano, which is on the Chinese-North Korean border. So a few interesting projects coming up there, and we'll see whether something else surprising happens in the volcanological world.
Well, I don't know if I'm jealous for you going to Eritrea to look at the volcanoes, or for the food. They got the bread and the vegetables with the sauce, and it's so good.
I'm a fan of that too.
And what's the but what's it like working on the China North Korea border? I mean, do you have a bunch of guys with, you know, in suits, and they're following you around? You got guys snapping pictures, and like, what's that like?
Well, we made a preliminary trip out there last year, and really just to sort of start to meet the Korean scientists and find out what they're doing and what they want to do to understand this volcano. It's certainly a more challenging place to work. We've got to work with a lot of export sanctions for any equipment that we might want to deploy in the country. It's not straightforward to communicate with our counterparts there, just things we take for granted like email and so on. So it's definitely a different kind of scientific mission with a sort of element of science diplomacy thrown in. But there are very well trained scientists there. They're very interested in the volcano, very interested in volcano monitoring, finding out where magma is located and so on, and thinking about volcanic hazards. So I think there's actually tremendous potential to build an international collaboration there. This particular volcano is very interesting. It was responsible for one of the largest eruptions in history, a little over 1,000 years ago. So that could well be a very interesting project, but certainly more challenging than a lot of the more routine work that I've been involved with.
Well, after a few nail-biting years in the geopolitical situation, it seems that things are starting to actually kind of mellow out a bit. You know, the food aid in exchange for some de-hostilization and, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff that I know nothing about. So, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. Would there be any websites that you would recommend for the listeners to check out for real-time data or summaries or anything like that?
A good starting point is the Smithsonian Institution's Global Volcanism Network. That should be easy enough to track down. They have a database of volcanic activity known for the last 10,000 years or so, and they put out regular reports summarizing new activity or ongoing activity, and that's a great resource, not just for the volcanological community, but for the wider community of people interested in global volcanism. So I certainly recommend that one.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You are definitely a gentleman and a scholar. I say that a lot, but I really mean it this time.
Well, thanks so much, Rick, for having me on the podcast. It's great to get all the questions, some great questions in there, and I'll follow with interest what you're up to.
Thank you very much. Well, we wouldn't have it if it weren't for those things that we take for granted, like email and Facebook. So kind regards, and all the best in your future endeavors.
Thanks, Rick. You too.
Cheers. Well, that was an incredible podcast. I really enjoyed that. Not to toot my own horn or anything, but I enjoyed that immensely. Stay tuned to solarimg.org for more, and we're going to work on rolling out the artist redesign. We're going to try getting it up from scratch. We've cleaned it up a bit so that you have to do less scrolling, and we're going to try and cross-link everything and roll out this new Artemis system. Facebook.com/solarimg, and thanks a lot. Take care.
try to knock us, baby. Nah. Don't try to hate. That's how we do it in that Lone Star State. Get it straight. We be.